It's the Distrusting Atheist edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, being fit and fat, Earth 2.0, beating babies for Jesus, and roots of atheist prejudice. Let's begin episode 144.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns.
We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And barely here is Don, your political science philosopher. I will apologize if I sound a little weird. I have a bit of a cold and a bit under the weather, but other than that, I think I'm still alive.
I'm definitely alive, and I'm Jenna, your biochemist.
Thanks for coming in, Don. We really appreciate that.
Well, you know, if you can't spread the germs with your friends, who can you spread them with?
Misery loves company, I think is what he's going for.
Yes.
That's right.
You know, it's been a really weird week. I've been, I was going to bring up a big topic recently about the USSR reemerging, right? Because apparently Vladimir Putin has signed a big deal with some of the former Soviet Union states to form something called the Eurasian Union. And I'm going, oh my God, you know, we've kind of talked about how Putin did this sort of double take and he's going to become leader of Russia again, and like, are we going to go back to the whole Cold War thing? And then I just noticed recently they had a big elections in Russia right now, and Vladimir Putin's party lost badly, relatively speaking. He still has 50% of the seats, but he used to have like 75% of the seats, and it's like, oh no, or is it three quarters? He had three quarters of the seats, but he lost a whole bunch. And I'm thinking, oh, this is a big rejection of Putin, and maybe we're going to be safe after all. And then I suddenly realize that, oh my God, I may actually be a conspiracy nut myself. Hmm. So I'm sitting there thinking, if I wanted to belay fears that I was a megalomaniac and that I'm intent on resurrecting the Soviet Union, one of the things I might do is manipulate my own elections so as to have my party have a slight defeat. Still have the majority, but a slight defeat. So people can't say, oh, he's rigged the elections, so that when it comes to the presidential elections, everybody said, well, he's a straight guy. We'll vote for him. He's not after any ulterior ulterior motives or whatever. And then I put on my tinfoil hat and sat in the corner and said no.
So we've got the truthers and the anti-vaxxers birthers. And the birthers, and now you are a Putiner.
Putiner.
Yeah. You're a Putiner.
Yeah. Well, you know, it could be worse. Another weird article that I was reading the other day, and I mean, you know, society can be really screwed up, and we often criticize religion for doing some really stupid things. And this is one of the cases where I think they've done a really stupid thing. I can't remember the country now. I'm sorry. I wish I could bring it to my mind.
He's literally breaking out into a cold sweat in the studio. I think I might send him home halfway through the show.
That's my superpower. Apparently, a woman was convicted of adultery in some Middle Eastern Muslim country. It might have been Saudi Arabia, but I'm guessing on that one. I know it was in that sort of general area. And she was convicted of adultery. The court had mercy on her because the adultery she committed was actually rape. She was raped by some gentleman. And they said, well,
clearly not much of a gentleman, just to put that out there.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, maybe. Because in an odd sort of way.
Don, go on.
Yes. The court had said that, you know, they would suspend the adultery conviction and she wouldn't be, like, stoned to death, provided she married the rapist.
In addition to her current husband? Because if it was adultery, she's got to have one.
Yes. Well, that's weird.
So now we're going for polygamy of women, or maybe the first husband died of shock.
I was just amazed that, you know, as far as marriage proposals go, this strikes me as probably one of the more disturbing ones and weird.
Yeah. Definitely not on the romantic side of things.
No. But we have a fantastic show this week.
We do. And on a more fit note.
Yes. So our level of physical fitness, as far as, you know, overall health in the room right now, is being dragged down by Dawn. But luckily, we have a new study on general fitness and the kind of things that it takes to keep you alive. Dawn, you might want to take note. So it seems like there's always some kind of new study popping up in the news about diet or fitness or obesity, etc. And granted, these are really important topics for public education, as the overall sedentary trend in our society is beginning to look rather alarming. I saw a commercial just this morning claiming that today's elementary school kids have a shorter life expectancy on average than their parents. So while I think that many of our listeners would agree with me that studies about general health are really important, I find that all too often they're really mean next to nothing. And this can be because they have really small sample sizes, maybe poorly controlled experiments or inappropriate study groups, and those kind of problems with the actual study that mean that the results that you get out really can't be extrapolated very far at all. However, there is a study in this week's edition of Circulation that caught my eye, as it had a relatively large sample size and seemed to use more than the usual rigor when it came to the data analysis phase.
When you say relatively large?
I'll get to the numbers in just a second. But yeah, no, we're talking thousands of participants. So the crux of the results of the study is that BMI, or body mass index, which is sort of a measure of over or underweightedness, doesn't have much of an effect at all on mortality from cardiovascular disease, or really from any cause of death. Whereas cardiovascular fitness, which can be measured by a treadmill test, is highly correlated with how soon or late you die. Basically, they found that you can kind of be fat as long as you're fit. So the study is based on data from 14,345 men. So this number is actually smaller than the over 16,000 men that were originally subjected to the experiment, as those with conditions like cardiovascular syndromes, cancer, or other obvious death-causing diseases were excluded from the study, as they might skew the results, as were those who were underweight and had unexplained weight fluctuations, or showed an unusually low heart rate under a stress test, or any of these sort of other major outliers. So all of the study participants had at least two physical examinations over 6 years, from which researchers were able to glean their baseline stats for body weight and fitness, as well as the change in those stats over that time. And then this was then this six-year period where they studied whether or not things were static or changing was followed by an 11-year follow-up study where they looked at the death rates of men from any cause and from cardiovascular disease specifically. So how do those numbers look into you, Don?
Good.
Excellent. Good to me too. So the bottom line from this study was that fitness trumps BMI when it comes to avoiding death. So for the numbers, there were 914 deaths that were recorded during that 11-year follow-up period. And 300 of those, so about a third, were from cardiovascular disease. So we know, you know, cardiovascular disease kills a lot of men. So men who increased in their fitness were significantly less likely to die during that 11 years than those who had a stable fitness level or those who decreased in their fitness level. So for every unit increase in fitness level, men were 15% less likely to die, period. So increase in fitness, very strongly correlated with less likely to die, and 19% less likely to die specifically of cardiovascular disease. So the kicker in this study, which was sort of the surprising bit, is that there was no such correlation observed for BMI changes. So, and this was after accounting for the fitness changes. So that is to say that even if the BMI increased, so that the person is getting fatter, if fitness also increased, the risk of death was still lower. And maybe even more surprising, if the fitness level decreased, so they were performed less well on the treadmill test, they were still more likely to die even if the BMI was going down. So if someone's getting thinner but getting sort of less cardiovascularly fit, they're still likely to die earlier. There's basically no correlation that they could measure for BMI with these mortality rates that could not be accounted for by the fitness level. So men who got fatter but fitter lived longer, and men who got thinner but wimpier died faster, and there were cats and dogs living together and all kinds of crazy things going on.
Well, I mean, my first question is, what is the variable of fitness that they're measuring here? They're saying, you know, people who are getting fitter, but fitter than what? What is this unit here?
So the first thing, one of the keys to this study is that it wasn't a single point. So a lot of studies had tried to correlate, or some studies had tried to correlate fitness and BMI and that kind of thing with mortality rates, but had taken only a single time point. So this was measuring the change in those two factors in a single individual, so from their own baseline, whether they were maintaining fitness, increasing fitness, decreasing fitness, and the same with BMI. And the actual test that they used is this treadmill stress test. And I would have to go back and look at the study to figure out what the actual unit corresponds to. But what they do is they stick you on a treadmill at sort of a moderate pace that's level. After 5 minutes, they crank it up to a bit of a slope and continue like that for about 25 minutes or so. And then they start every minute, they ramp up the rate until you plead with them, please, please stop, let me get off this treadmill. Or they say, your heart's about to explode, please get off the treadmill, sir.
And so, have any of them actually go pop while they're on the treadmill?
Not that I'm aware of, but if such a thing happened, that individual certainly would have been excluded from the study. They had fairly stringent criteria for who was included.
Yeah.
So while the big numbers and fairly stringent statistical analysis in this study make the findings pretty convincing, there are a couple of factors that are important to consider when thinking about how this data might relate to a certain population, i.e., you know, us. So first of all, the participants were from middle to high socioeconomic status, and they were college grads almost exclusively. They were almost all white men. In addition to this. And furthermore, they were on average slightly overweight, and less than 10% of the people that participated in the study were obese. So it's important to keep these factors in mind, as the results may only be applicable to people in this group. So for example, it's known that people of Indian descent exhibit fatty tissue with very different characteristics than Caucasian people, and this can actually impact their risk factors for obesity-related complications as well as cardiovascular disease. So you might also notice that I keep saying men. This is because women were also not included in the study, and you can imagine how those, you know, the differences in gender physiology could play a major role. BMI has also been a controversial method for assessing body fat content in obesity, although the authors did test this by measuring body fat percentage by other methods, and it did correlate well with the BMI statistically.
There's also another issue, too, I think, that would need to be a follow-up. We're sort of in a unique period of time where the idea of childhood obesity and its long-term effects is something that needs to be played out. I mean, we can't test it now because we've really never had a period in time where we've had obesity in a significant number of the population in childhood, and whether their fitness rates, irrespective of their BMI, will correlate with that as well. I mean, because there's a lot of other secondary issues that come up besides cardiovascular disease. There's things like liver disease,
right,
kidney failure, that
absolutely
sort of thing.
And those are things that are, again, correlated with sort of morbid obesity, whereas this study was, again, looking at men who are slightly overweight, but the authors are not drawing any conclusions whatsoever about people who might follow into an obese or morbidly obese category, in which case those risk factors that are associated with that condition compared to just being having a slightly elevated BMI are potentially going to trump the effects that they're seeing with the fitness.
Of course, there's also the other, sorry, just to put a dark side to everything. The more fit you are, the
it's
more...
It's okay, I see your rain cloud today.
The more wear and tear you put on joints and that sort of thing, which is also a secondary condition you get.
Depending on your prescribed method of fitness, like swimming and that kind of thing is going to be a lot less wearing, or elliptical training and that kind of thing can be... There are options that you can have high cardiovascular fitness without putting undue stress on other body systems. So regardless of the specific limitations of the study, the findings really do carry some pretty interesting implications for a significant proportion of the North American population, which, of course, lots of people living on this continent are, you know, white, fairly well off, men who are slightly overweight. So firstly, while BMI is popularly associated with health, this study would actually suggest that for average-ish people, body weight is more correlative than causative with respect to overall health, and that being overweight might be more of a symptom of inactivity and poor fitness than a cause of mortality.
There's one other factor, too, and sorry, you mentioned most people in North America.
Lots.
The incidence of obesity, though, in Native American populations and some other populations around the world are dramatically higher.
Absolutely.
And I wonder if this provides an opportunity for them, too. Because, I mean, it seems to me their particular issue isn't so much being lazy, per se.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a genetic factor. But yeah. This may offer them an ability to counteract.
Well, in light of studies like this, it might be interesting to look at where there are, like, for example, I know Inuit people and that stuff, their physiology lends to a higher BMI. And I'm wondering whether in light of studies like this, you could take a look at the mortality rates versus the BMI and see if there's even less of a correlation there than with a Caucasian population. And the authors are actually careful not to overstep their real findings and in considering all these different racial issues and that kind of thing. And in fact, they only suggest that physical activity is likely to be a top factor in influencing fitness change, which led me to sort of think that maybe the alternative is, you know, magically acquiring fitness related powers through pure willpower. But they also note that a previous twin study performed in Sweden backs up the results, as this group found that weight loss from dieting was associated with actually increased mortality, while weight loss due to physical activity didn't show any such mortality.
What? Are you saying the Swedish result says if you lose weight, you're going to die?
Actually, so there are studies that weight loss is associated with mortality. Now, sometimes this is weight loss. It, again, depends on how the study is controlled and stuff, because if you include cancer patients and that kind of thing, then weight loss is associated with a disease state that's associated with mortality. However, the sum of studies reading through the discussion of this one seems to sort of indicate that weight fluctuations, whether up or down, when it's not associated with increased physical activity and increased fitness, does seem to be correlated with mortality. So yes, sort of massive dieting and losing weight can actually increase death rates, arguably. But the bottom line to this study seems to be right in line with public health mandates that seem to be constantly coming down the tube, which is to get active and stay active and thus live longer. So while the extreme caloric restriction that we've been hearing about has been hailed by many as a proverbial elixir of life when it comes to longevity, it seems to me that enjoying a cheeseburger or perhaps a nice plate of pancakes after a good bike ride might be the way to go if you're talking quality of life. And I'm thinking that maybe Hal Johnson and Joanne McLeod had it right all those years. Stay fit and have fun and stay alive.
That's like an inside joke for people who have seen that show. At
who
like
hasn't?
Yeah.
It's still on.
Well,
it was on when I was in grade one.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, why don't we go to a commercial break and our listeners can run around the block once or twice. And we'll be back
eating
with
their
more.
Cheeseburgers.
Yeah, with the cheeseburger, yeah, absolutely.
Excellent.
Stay tuned.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Thank you very much for coming out this evening. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Get fucked to kind.
To all our CITR homies, we dedicate this shout-out to you for your support of our fresh beats.
You really knew what time it was during our 2011 fund drive, and we thank you, thank you, thank you for being so kind.
Big love and ups from your crew at CITR 101.9 in Vancouver. And until next year, remember to keep it real.
Is the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. We're back on Radio Free Thinker.
Now, for a more uplifting switch of things. Okay, it's not. Sorry, this is going to sound horrible. Beating Babies for Jesus. The shadowy world of right-wing disciplinary guides. There's a brutal movement in America that legitimizes child abuse in the name of God. Now, this is not everyone who believes in God, but there is a small segment of the population that adheres to this. Two stories recently converged to bring my attention to this. About 2 weeks ago now, a video went viral of a Texas judge who was brutally whipping his disabled daughter. If you ever see it, it's quite disturbing. And a couple of weeks ago, a New York Times article published a story about a child's death in the home of parents who had embraced the teachings of, quote, To Train Up a Child, a book by Christian preacher Michael Pearl, which advocates using a switch on children as young as 6 months old.
And a switch is a...
It's a stick.
Yeah.
I define it better later. Mm-hmm. In 1977, this movement kind of got started with James Dobson, founder of Focus on the Family's religious empire and radio program. He wrote a book called Dare to Discipline, whose main purpose was essentially to get parents to beat their children. In his book, Dobson glorifies the sadomasochistic spiritual ritual of discipline. He says he wanted to stop a liberal trend in America that was moving away from godly thrashing of children and wanted to help restore America to God and the good old days of child hitting. I mean, it's in the Bible. It's ordained. It must be good. In The Strong-Willed Child, 1992, Dobson says, and I quote, I have seen this defiant move before, and I knew there was only one way to deal with it. The only way to make my dog, Siggy, obey is to threaten him with destruction. Nothing else works. I turned, went to the closet, and got a small belt to help me reason with my Mr. Freud. He goes on to use the same analogy later on to say, just as surely as a dog will occasionally challenge the authority of his leader, so will a little child, only more so. Dobson is gently compared to authors of To Train a Child, where they advocate beating babies, starting with switching a seven-month-old baby's bare bottom or legs 7 to 8 times as a punishment for getting angry. If the baby is still angry, they urge the parent to repeat the punishment until the child gives in to the pain. The switch they recommend for under 1-year-old is the form of a willow tree or a 6-inch ruler. A California couple has been charged with murder of their adopted 7-year-old daughter and torture of their 11-year-old adopted daughter and 10-year-old biological son. The 7-year-old died after a disciplinary session. The parents allegedly used a 15-inch length of plastic tubing used to beat the child, a practice recommended in the book To Train Up Your Child. More than 670,000 copies of Pearl's self-published books are in circulation and is especially popular among Christian homeschoolers who praise it praise it in their magazines and on their websites. A strong force in this movement is the Reconstructionist Dominion Theology, which is about applying literal Old Testament law, including an execution of incorrigible youth, as mandated by the Bible. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that religious makes all parents beat their children or injure them or kill them. However, it does help provide three negative things for the family environment. One of them is male domination.
Now, when you say that religion is providing these things for the household, I mean, I assume that we're talking about more or less a specific stream or a specific group of streams.
Well, religion can, in general, support this idea. These people have just taken that one inkling of it and sort of taken it to a logical extreme. So, like I say, 90% of Christians, maybe 99%.
I was going to say 90?
Well, it's a much stronger movement in the United States than most people give it credit for.
Which is really unfortunate.
Yeah. Probably less so here, but there are a number of these sort of fundamentalist types here in Canada that do adhere to this sort of idea.
And I could point out as well, getting sort of what Jenna was implying, like male domination is fairly constantly enforced in most, especially sort of divine revealed religions. I can think of only a handful that don't explicitly state, you know, the man is the head of the household. Even most Eastern religions have it written very clearly,
right?
Especially Confucianism. I mean, there's a few kind of what you might characterize as sort of New Agey religions that emphasize female empowerment, but
or equality. Like I guess I just wanted to sort of put in a little bit of a comment that it's not right across the board.
Actually, allow me to fill out that argument just a little bit. So the man is the father of the household, and like, quote, our Lord Father, should be obeyed without question. This reinforces gender equality, treats children as chattel, and provides an excuse, or at least an obfuscation, for abusive behavior. Now, as you guys have pointed out, this is not necessarily unique to Christianity, but it does take on a more sinister theme because of the overt theology. If in other traditions or mythic-based cultures, the man may be the head of the household, and failure to heed his wishes is punishable. However, it is, I believe, uniquely in the Abrahamic religion, raises this crime of independence to a sin. Let us remember that one of the sins is to disobey one's parents in Ten Commandments, and the wives must submit to their husbands, Ephesians 5:22-24. So you're right. I mean, male domination is almost a global characteristic of society, whether that's good or bad. But one of the things that the Judeo-Christian concept of version of this is it has elevated it to not only to be wrong, but to be eternally damned.
And for sure, I agree in a lot of the more sort of maybe traditional or, I'm forgetting my words right now, but sort of sex. But I guess I just wanted to point out that there's a lot of people out there that are going to identify as Christian who those groups of Christianity have sort of moved away from some of those more fundamentalist beliefs.
And again, I'm not arguing that point, really.
Oh, yeah. No, I just wanted to, you know, for any of our listeners who might identify in that way,
well,
we're not trying
you
to...
You get the same thing. There are a number of people who, quote-unquote, are Christian and believe in evolution.
Yeah.
Right? And there's a varying sort of degree of compartmentalization of my religious faith versus the reality of the world. And as I say, this... We're not talking with the majority of Christians.
Oh, for sure. And just because some people are reasonable does not mean that we should turn a blind eye to some of the more horrific things that other groups are doing that might be under the same general umbrella.
But this leads to my second point. Abuse camouflage. In a community that not only tolerates but encourages sort of minor violence, again, a lot of people will sit there and say, you know, slapping a child for stealing a candy is not a horrible thing. I mean, if you've ever had children... Right, I haven't, but I've been told as a child that I have more than once pressed the nerves of my parents to the point where a switch would not have been unthinkable. But when you put it in the terms of, in the name of training your child, it I don't know, for those parents who are sadistic and cruel, it's easier for them to disguise the degree of abuse that they may do. Essentially provides a shield under which they can hide. So again, even if 99% of the people who sort of follow this doctrine are doing so in a very ethical way,
yep,
if that's possible, it provides the cover for that 1% to do something that we would consider unethical and say, hey, listen, it's my religious belief. How dare you do this?
Absolutely.
Many of the spare the rod, spoil the child state that the level of violence they advocate is minimal. But like I say, what qualifies as minimal? Is bruising too much? What about pains that don't leave a scar? What might be sanctionable by one God, what might be sanctionable by God by one religious sect may be too gentle for another? And again, it provides this, when you leave your morality up to some imaginary creature in the sky, there seems to be no limit on what you can make that, what work it can do.
Well, also, and you mentioned sort of the culture of violence, even if it's not what we consider extreme violence, but even if it's what we might think of minor violence, but even that will have an effect on the community, and it'll make it extremely difficult for someone who is being abused to get help in that kind of a culture. I mean, if you have a child who was horribly beaten but maybe didn't leave a lot of marks, and they're trying to get help...
Especially if it was called a spanking or
yeah.
called a... you know, a correction.
And they go to their teacher or whatever, and they say, you know, I got beat, and they call their parents and say, well, what happened? I gave him a spanking. He was being bad.
Yeah.
That puts the victim in the position of proving that they were abused.
The burden of proof lying in exactly the wrong place.
Well, again, you know, actually, this religious freedom can be used as a get-out-of-jail-free card, literally, for so many actions. Religious barbarism like this just makes a peaceful church complacent in the crime. In fact, it creates a space where systematic hitting of children is okay, allowing those who abuse by nature to exist unmolested as they harm and destroy a generation. Again, we can look at the Catholic pedophilia sort of thing that went on, right? That doesn't mean every Catholic who went to church abused young children.
Mm-hmm.
No, but because they had set up this sort of
framework,
artifice, it allowed for these people to exist and to go undetected for so long until society said, hey, listen, there should be no space like this left. The third area, and this is the one in these particular books that bothered me kind of the most, is the idea of dehumanization. What I think is one of the main goals, and this is a personal opinion, so don't jump on me too hard, of organized religion is to systematically and completely break down the will of its followers. One can only lead a congregation if they all believe they are sheep in a compliant flock. Physical and psychological abuse, training, is the activity of not only making them obedient, but complacent. Many of these proponents of child abuse use terms that are dehumanizing. Training your child like a pet, something to entertain and serve you. It's of no value of its own right. It just strikes me as wrong that you train your child, you teach your child, you help your child. But when you use these terms, you're somehow denying them a sense of value. This serves not to make better citizens, better people, but only to make better sheep for churches to lead and to dominate and to control. Now, of course, not all religious people are bad. Most religious people are not bad. But religion does help make it easier for those who are not nice to get away with doing bad things. And especially in this particular case of this extremist religion, it's even more so.
Well, why don't we take a quick break after that segment, and we'll be back with more on Radio Freethinker after this.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
In this time, standing on a planet, really I'm just a speck, compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR, and there's a news story that's sort of making the rounds, Don.
Well, I don't know if I trust you. Ethan,
you don't know if you trust me?
Well, you know, apparently there's this pervasive thought that you can't trust atheists. And recently,
well, I am kind of a jerk.
Well, that's true.
Correlative.
No, apparently, religious people don't really hate atheists. They just don't trust them. Well, you know, it might be, you might think they feel threatened because we threaten their worldview. We push for justice with regards to the Pope. We call for the abolition of tax-free status for churches. Hell, dismantling of all churches is one of the things we call for in theological institutions. Seems like that would be sufficient for religious people to not like us. Well, according to research done by local UBC researcher Will Javeris, apparently no relationship to Rick Javeris, the comedic guy from The Office, I believe.
Ricky Gervais.
Thank you. We missed the boat.
Just helping out.
The real reason they don't trust us the real reason they don't like us is they don't trust us. Sorry. The premise behind this thinking is that prejudice is somehow a socio-functional artifact of society. That at some level, prejudice evolved as sort of a safety mechanism, a shorthand to prevent the destruction of the in-group. A classic example is, why do we feel an innate fear of foreigners? One reason is that it has across evolutionary time, when you see another group, odds are they were there to kill and steal your stuff. So if you just have a natural fear of them, you would be better off to either run away or to attack them first.
Well, and doesn't that go even a little bit deeper? Because, I mean, humans generally have a fear of all that is new and different.
Yeah, actually,
like not just people.
In the preamble to his article, he had mentioned the fact that white Americans fear African Americans. And he doesn't, I mean, he cites other articles, which I didn't have a chance to size up. But yeah, it's the sort of the premise here, though, is that a lot of the ideas of prejudice come about because they serve some sort of socio-functional element.
Yeah.
Right?
So that kind of blend of evolutionary psychology as well that's kind of in this and the whole idea as well.
Exactly. And that's kind of what he's trying to tap in. Of course, this simplistic view does not account for the more complex examples of prejudice, like against atheists.
Gervais,
thank you. I thought one mechanism that may account for this is that to address why religion itself evolved. Many scholars hold that one reason religion came about, one of the things it does allows people to work together by sort of offloading the enforcement costs of social cohesion to some supernatural entity. Community cohesion can be maintained at a minimal cost. Using this presupposition, Gervais believes that anything that upset this sort of trust mechanism would be seen as a threat. That is, if you reject the supernatural entity, you are no longer bound to be civilized, i.e. atheists could not be trusted. So he set about to test this hypothesis.
So wait, these conjectures that he's making here, which I use the word conjecture because I don't want to use the word wild conjecture, was this in the introduction or the discussion of this particular study?
This is in the introduction. This is sort of the... This is why this. So he sort of says, "Okay, I'm gonna."
Like he's pre-interpreting.
I have this hypothesis.
Yeah.
Right, and so now I'm gonna test to see whether this hypothesis.
But it doesn't seem to be only a hypothesis, because what he's testing is whether or not people trust atheists. But before he tests it, he says why.
Well, I think he's hypothesizing why they don't trust atheists. I mean, it's pretty well.
It seems really backwards.
Well, no,
it's pretty established that people don't trust atheists.
And I think the idea here is that there's already this body of evidence that says that socio-functionality is one of the root causes for prejudice in itself. So if we assume that the socio-functional theory is correct, how can we apply it to atheists to account for why there's this anti-atheist bias in
society? In his defense, he does cite a number of studies as he's going through his introduction.
Right. Yeah. It just seems to me that maybe should come after the results of the study, but... That's my own scientific opinion.
You have to put
opinion.
All the juicy stuff up front, otherwise you get really bored. And trust me, I was going through this.
Beef up the abstract, buddy.
I was going through some of the statistical math about this, and it was weird. And a lot of it is because it's sort of negative correlation that you're dealing with because...
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Continue.
The study he used manipulates an old study that went something like this. People have told a story about Jennifer. They said she was a young woman who was concerned about social issues. They were then asked which was more likely: A, she was a banker, she works at a bank, or B, she works at a bank and is a feminist. The vast majority of people answered B, which statistically speaking is impossible. That is, the probability that she works in a bank is X, let's say 10%, and the probability that she works at a bank and is a feminist is X times Y, and let's say 10% for both, so 10% times 10% is actually 1%, which is, it's always going to be smaller that two things correlate than one thing correlates. Now, this is...
Although I hope that the subjects of that study had that explained to them very clearly, because the way it reads intuitively, if you're not reading it particularly, with an investigative tone, it sounds like she works in a bank and is not really a feminist, and she works in a bank and is a feminist. The second term sort of modifies the first.
This is the conjunctive fallacy, whereby our judgments is warped by our persuasive combination of plausible details, which we are a much better storytellers than we are logicians. It is also social biased. We think it is more likely a socially conscious woman to be a feminist, so B is the more likely answer because we think part of the answer is more likely. However, probability is usually, sorry, however, probability, just, it just doesn't work that way.
No, I know, but so, I totally get that. But what I'm saying is that because I feel that this adding that second thing to the second part of the answer actually can sort of manipulate the person into injecting a second term into the first part of the answer as well, even though there isn't one.
No, that's the whole point. That's actually the result in a way that you're looking at. Because if you look at it neutrally, without any sort of prejudice or bias, you'll say the banker, right? But if you assume, because you have a prejudice against socially conscious females, must be a feminist, that's going to point out at you. And even though logically it doesn't make any sense, your bias will point to feminist. And you ignore the fact that the bank's even there. That's kind of what they're going for. Because you are right. In a intuitive sense of the idea, I mean, it's obvious why you'd think that was sorry, now I'm falling into the thing. It should be obvious. But that's what they're playing upon, is that our logic circuits aren't very logical a lot of the time. And you get this conjunctive fallacy where we make a connection that we really shouldn't be making, but we do because of our social bias.
I do understand. I think that there's a distinction that actually, I think there's a slight confounding variable in the study, but continue.
That confounds me. Gervais twisted the story four ways to show anti-atheist prejudice. So he reworded this, the example. He said, Richard is a 31-year-old man, which is good because Richard could have been a woman, I guess.
And if he's slightly overweight, as long as he's fit, he's good to go.
On his way to work one day, he accidentally backed his car into a parked van. Because pedestrians were watching, he got out of his car, he pretended to write down his insurance information, and then tucked the blank note onto the van's window before getting back into the car and driving away.
Someone totally did that to me once.
Later the same day, hopefully no one did this to you, Richard found a wallet on the sidewalk. Nobody was looking, so he took out all the money and threw the wallet in the trash can.
Someone totally did that to me once, except it was an orchard, not a trash can.
the question now asked is it more likely Richard is a teacher or a teacher and a? And the study paired teacher, which actually I thought was kind of interesting profession. Richard must not have liked his doctoral advisor or something. So he paired it with a Christian, a Muslim, a rapist, and an atheist. As it turned out, based on my readings of the study, and they say it got a little detect, because what they're measuring here is how many people got the wrong answer, who fell into this conjunctive fallacy. So it's kind of a negative result. But my reading of it, 5% thought Richard was a Christian, 15% a Muslim. Then we jump up to 40% thought he was a rapist, and sadly over 50% thought Richard was an atheist.
So are these of people who thought that he was a teacher and something else?
Yes.
Okay.
So
sort of taking the first part of it right out of there.
Yeah, so the correct answer would have been logically, he was a teacher. And on all these results, except for the atheist, the majority of people did not fall into the conjunctive fallacy.
Okay.
But of those people who did fall into conjunctive fallacy, you had 5% Christian, 15% Muslim, 40% rapist, and over 50% atheist. As part of the study, he also did variations where Richard was described in disgusting terms. If you're eating something, I would put it away, and you may want to have a bag handy. Richard is a 31-year-old man. Due to a rare inherited medical condition, this leads him to have dry, flaky skin, which produces excess mucus. His skin often flakes off in embarrassing times, and he almost always has a drippy nose and phlegm in his throat. Like me at the moment. On his way to work one day, Richard was scratching his itchy shoulder. Some of the dry skin that flaked off caused him to sneeze, and some snot ended up on his tie. He failed to notice it that was on his tie. He wore this dirty tie through the entire work day. So that's what he did. In this case, gay men were twice as more likely to be conjoined with the disgust terminology than with an atheist. So the idea here was they were trying to say which one is more associated with the idea of disgust, right? And as it turned out, homosexuality was termed more with that than with atheism. But when the same test was run again, but the terms were not used, discussed, but unpleasantness and untrustworthiness, the homosexuality correlated with the distrust 5%, while atheists were 50%. None of them ever broke the 10% mark for unpleasantness, although the homosexuals were more unpleasant than atheists. There were two more runs of this experiment. One substituted Richard with Sarah. Sarah could also be misidentified as a feminist, a Jew, or an atheist. Again, I'm not really sure where he got some of these groups from, but this is what he did.
He totally should have included Baby Beater.
Yeah. But Sarah was seen as a Jewish person 50% of the time, as a feminist 25% of the time, and an atheist almost 50% of the time. The last run, asking about hiring, and this I thought was kind of interesting as well. So you had two professions, one that was seen as high trust, a daycare provider, and low trust, a waitress or a waiter.
Where you're just trusting them to not spit in your food.
Yeah, well, see, that was the first thought that came into my mind.
I kind of don't trust. I think that's a trust position.
Oddly enough, atheists were selected almost 65% of the time as a hostess, while only 35% of them would have had them as daycare providers. Now, the conclusion of the study was that prejudice against atheists was widespread and deeply ingrained. It also stated that the growing and important segment of society research into why and how this prejudice manifests itself should be pursued. Honestly, reading both the preamble and the conclusionary of it, it seemed like one of the things that Gervais was trying to go for is that he believes that there's a lot of prejudice against atheists, and we need to do more research to find out how and why it exists.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to be the most important aspect of everything, which kind of goes with your sort of thing. I think it's almost like he had a conclusion in mind, and then he tried to supply data to support that conclusion.
Which, I mean, like, so part of the scientific method, obviously, is coming up with a hypothesis. Well, the classical scientific method is coming up with a hypothesis and then testing that hypothesis and then being able to accept or reject it. But that can really, you have to be really careful with how you're then going to design your experiment and interpret the results without bias. Like, you state a hypothesis is stated with bias, just the way it sounds. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean you follow it up that way. But however, my biggest problem with the, sort of the main body of the study as far as, you know, associating mistrust or whatever with different kinds of groups is the psychology that I imagine would be involved with the study participants. So, for example, if I was participating in this study, I think I'd feel really uncomfortable, you know, pointing a finger at Muslims, pointing a finger at Christians, or different people that I felt I had no right to point a finger at. Whereas to me, atheists are more of a nebulous group. So if you had to choose between all of those groups, then it's sort of one that has a little less moral responsibility on the study participant. Whereas I was just thinking while you were talking here that you know, if you're going to correlate that with a rapist, then God help you if you've ever done one of those things yourself.
Well, actually, there is another aspect to this. And again, I couldn't figure out how to weave this into the narrative of our talk today. But there should be a link to this on our website. And if you go read it, he does actually have a part of his statistical analysis is he asked on a scale of like 1 to 10 or 1 to 100 or variation of that, how important do you think God is or how important do you think a entity is to maintaining social order? So there were some sort of overt religious classifications in this that he used as part of his statistical analysis.
Well, I guess I'm saying that it seems like in this study, it seems like the atheist group is a lot more anonymous and probably has a lot fewer faces than a person can picture sitting there trying to answer, you know, saying that, because it's very recognizable that they're associating distrustful behavior with a specific type of person. And so I think the more nebulous group that is atheists, it being very large and also not necessarily particularly organized in the same way that a lot of religious groups are, that it's a lot easier to point a finger at a group you can't see than pointing a finger at a group that you can. I think the moral implications of that for the self of the person who's participating might actually be a factor in this study.
Well, I think that the fact that you can't visibly recognize an atheist is a big part of this, but also because that gives it a more sinister tone. If these people who you think are untrustworthy are invisible, so to speak, you can't tell them apart from, you know, the good, honest, God-fearing citizens, then that is going to color your interpretation of where they fit in with society. I mean, the thing is, like, what I've always heard in regards to distrust of atheists is that even if you disagree with somebody's religious views, if you think that, you know, I'm a Christian and they're a Muslim, they're obviously wrong, but at least they, you know, have the decency to believe in something. Whereas atheists, they're just so stupid and so crazy that they don't believe in anything at all.
Well, the whole idea is that, you know, why aren't you out there killing and raping people? I mean, there's nothing holding you back. Whereas, again, which makes me really question Christian ethics, the only reason why you're not killing me is because you're worried about some mythical beast. But
well, that was one of the things he mentions in the study, is that a lot of religious people cite their belief in God as a moral force in the world, which I have a lot of take issue with, because A, I don't think it is. I think that if you just look at the behavior of the Catholic Church or suicide bombers or any group, it clearly isn't a deterrent that much, but it's perceived as a deterrent. And for the average person who is religious, if they perceive it as a deterrent, they're going to assume that atheists don't see it as a deterrent, and therefore are more likely to steal or cheat or be a rapist, apparently.
And they're also, in sort of more gentle terms, might be more of a correlation in the mind of Christians that might not be of a more extreme sect. So, you know, in going to church and then in that activity, part of that is questioning morality and examining moral issues and that kind of thing. So there could be a connection between, you know, thinking about your own morality and the church, even though they're not necessarily like the church causes me to be moral, but that is where I think of morality.
Haha, but I've tricked you all.
Damn!
Yep. Because remember, one of the things that he's worried about, he's not so much worried about why do Christians not trust us, but why is there in society anti-atheist prejudice? And it's, I think what he's going for here is more of the cultural social bias that even as atheists we may interpret. Because one thing, then the last thing I have to really mention about this, is I went back and I looked at the statistical data he had about the study group that he did. And a curious fact about the demographics, it turned out that almost 50% of those in this particular study did not actually identify themselves as religious at all. They were either atheist or agnostic or that sort of thing. Which, again, one, makes his interpretation for religious prejudice against us somewhat dubious. But as far as cultural bias against us, that also means that atheists don't really trust themselves to a certain degree.
Well, that could also relate to the fact that identifying as an atheist is a certain step that many people just won't take. They won't even consider themselves agnostic. They'll just consider themselves non-religious. I think a lot of people assume that atheism is sort of the religion of, you know, Dawkins and Hitchens and such, and that they don't associate that with you know, non-religiousness.
Actually, another interesting part of this, and I don't know how this would factor in, but almost half of them were East Asian. Mm. We're in this group.
I actually think that the fact that lots of them were atheists or non-religious people not trusting atheists totally sort of is to my hypothesis that atheists are safe to blame from a moral standpoint.
Yeah, well, you're an atheist. I don't trust you.
But it does give
don't label me
some perspective to some of the recent outreach campaigns by various secular organizations in the States. The popular one where they show a well-known, most cases minor celebrity, but saying someone doesn't believe in God, now you know, like an atheist or something, and they, you know, feature like the Mythbusters or something.
Well, or you get very famously in the United States that you're much more likely to be elected president as a gay Christian than you are as an atheist monogamist, right? Yeah. I mean, the killer is not so much your sexual orientation states, even though there's huge prejudice against that. But compare that to atheism or non-religious belief, you're much more condemned with the other.
Well, there definitely seems to be a lot of misunderstanding about people's point of view that do identify as atheists, and it seems to me that there needs to be a fairly broad education campaign to be able to speak to a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds to help them understand where people are coming from.
So what you're proposing is we need some kind of organization that can advocate for atheist issues.
Yeah, it works really well for the church.
Yeah. Well, we should get one of those. Yes. Well, we're running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so maybe we should go to our skeptical highlights.
Sure. I have a kind of a weird series of them. They're all interrelated, so bear with me on this one. So, the article. Good science always has political ramifications. Why? Because a scientifically testable claim can be shown to be either most probably true or false, whether the claim is made by a king or a president, a pope, a congressman, or a common citizen. Because science pushes the boundaries of knowledge, it pushes us to constantly redefine our ethics and morality, and what is, and this is always a political act. Beyond that, science can constantly disrupts the hierarchies of power structure, vested interest in the long drive towards knowledge, and thus giving us power, power to the individuals, power to the process. So this is an article that I found in Scientific America that sort of says, you know, science should be preoccupied with science, but it can't ignore the fact that there are political ramifications to science. Most notably is the climate change debate, which is going on currently. Which leads me to my second bit. The book, Fool Me Twice, The Fight, Fighting the Assault on Science in America by Sean Lawrence Otto. In this book, the author points out that only about 2% of politicians have any science background. Most popular media is antithetical to science, while promoting things like fringe science or pseudoscience, or worse, doing that sort of thing where there's these people on this one side, and then there's one guy on the other side, therefore they have equal weight. It's a behind-the-scenes look at how the government, our politics, and the media prevent us from finding out real solutions we need to do, and offering suggestions of what we can do to change this course. Third, the conference. I'm not sure how many people know this, but currently right now, the Durban Climate Change Conference is going on in South Africa. It has just started, and to show what a dysfunctional country we have become, the Harper government has let it be known that we are about to officially abandon the Kyoto Accord and essentially giving the middle finger to the rest of the world. They're trying to come up with some replacement for the Kyoto Accord, which is about to run out of time. And although we haven't actually done anything to do it, we did actually lend it some moral support, but we even dropped that. It's a non-starter, and no one thinks that anything will be accomplished at this conference. In fact, beyond the possibility that lesser nations that are on the verge of extinction because of climate change, usually due to increased levels of water levels, may elicit some moral support. Most major nations are abandoning any coordinated activity on climate change for economic reasons. The media. Democracy Now! Has a week-long coverage of the Durban conference. Democracy Now! Is an independent media outlet that provides the most comprehensive coverage of this climate change conference. To be fair, they are not the most corporate-friendly, and they do have a very strong bias, but they do provide a balance against the pro-corporate mass media. You will hear sides of the debate that are never covered in the mainstream media. So you should check that out at democracynow.org. And the endpoint. we plan to do a special episode in the future as to how to plan for, well, we might not, but maybe we will. I was very gung-ho when I read this, and I'm very depressed now. So we had planned to do
it's
a special
just
episode
the fever
in the future
talking.
As to how to plan for dramatic climate change in the near future. It seems apparent that the corporate governance, and that's my leftist view, will prevent us from doing anything beyond a token effort to alleviate, let alone prevent, dramatic climate change in our lifetimes. So that if we are going to crash, and we are going to crash, how can we prepare ourselves for this sort of post-apocalyptic world we will have by century's end? Let us know what you think. Fortunately for me, I'll probably be dead by the end of the century and not suffering. Sorry, Ethan and Jenna, looks like you have unhappy days ahead.
Well, by those of us who live in the south coast of British Columbia here, my advice is lots of rubber boots.
Rubber boots, yes. Well, my skeptical highlight.
More uplifting, I hope.
Slightly, yes. I know that some of you out there are probably going to be purchasing gifts and or accessories for family and friends. I'd like to recommend a book that I've been reading recently. It's by a fellow named Steven Pinker called The Better Angels of Our Nature. And it's all about the decline in violence, the counterintuitive notion that human beings are actually getting more peaceful as we progress. I'm reading it. It's quite interesting, very challenging at times, and I do encourage you to pick it up and take a look. It's quite fascinating.
Ethan, no, you're crazy. I turn on the TV all the time, and there's always violence happening somewhere in the world. How can you possibly say that the world is becoming less violent?
Well, Pinker does an interesting job of explaining the discrepancy between media reportations and actual violence. I encourage you to read the book.
Oh, we demonize the media so much. As for me, I have a bit of a hook for you. So three words, rice, water, stool. Stay tuned.
No, that's pleasant. Okay, well, that's it for Radio Free Thinker today. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Jenna saying, Don, go home and get some rest because you need to appreciate how much the real world is amazing.
Aw.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
Pick up your winter issue of Discorder, as the Jan-cember issue is packed with goodies that will warm even the coldest of cockles. Take a dip with Dixie's Death Pool, a spacey art rock collective, or read up on local outsider pop music makers, World Club. Cozy up on the couch with Filmstripped, featuring a review of Color Me Obsessed, a documentary on The Replacements. And in case you missed the memo, 2012 is almost here. Check out the Discorder album picks of 2011. Don't forget to pick up your special Jan-cember issue of Discorder.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Canada.